In the coming week, former President Donald Trump's second impeachment trial begins in the Senate. Myanmar faces the fallout after a military coup, and the U.S. extends the New START nuclear treaty with Russia. It's February 4th, 2021, and time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay.
Jim, in the coming week, the second impeachment trial of former President Trump is set to begin on Tuesday. As of now, Democrats and Republicans remain divided, it's safe to say, on whether or not to convict the former president for his role in inciting the attack on the U.S. Capitol last month. Give us some background, Jim. What's the state of play in the Senate right now?
Well, Bob, there's a lot to unpack here, so let's begin with the logistics and the stakes. Like Trump's first impeachment trial, the proceedings in the Senate are going to kick off noon each day, and the trial is going to run 6 days a week, with senators having Sundays off. Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont is set to preside over the trial. That's because Chief Justice John Roberts declined to do it. Now, the Constitution requires the Chief Justice to preside over impeachment trials only when the president is being tried. Now, Trump is a former president. More on that in a moment because it's significant. Now, Leahy gets to preside because he is the longest serving Democrat. Now, in standing Senate rules, the majority party decides who presides over all impeachment trials not involving a sitting president. Typically, that is the longest serving member. Now, neither the Democrats nor the Republicans seem to want a long trial, but how long the trial lasts will depend on things like how long do the House managers take to present their cases, how long do Trump's lawyers take to present their rebuttal, how many questions do senators ask, do they call witnesses. You may recall in the last impeachment trial of Donald Trump, the Senate, then controlled by Republicans, called no witnesses. And obviously for the Senate, the longer this trial takes, the less time the Senate has for other business. And I think it's safe to say the Senate has a lot of business to do. In terms of the stakes, given that Trump is no longer president, removal from office is off the table. There's obviously the historic black mark of being the first president ever convicted in an impeachment trial. But beyond that, the Senate could, and likely would if Trump were convicted, to take a second step, and that's the vote to bar him from ever holding federal office again. And unlike a vote to convict, which requires a two-thirds vote, barring someone who's been convicted from holding federal office requires only a majority vote. And in that case, Trump would lose his benefits like his lifetime pension, travel budget, funding for office staff, and things like that.
So, Jim, do we then not see necessarily a full-fledged discussion of what the president did or did not say earlier on January 6th and then the run-up to that? It's more sort of the, you know, precedents and procedures?
Well, here, Bob, you put your finger on the important question, which is Trump likely to be convicted? And I think the answer to that is no. Now, keep in mind, in impeaching Trump, who was then in office, the House accused him of inciting the January 6th attack on the Capitol. Trump's defense team, which has come together only at the last moment, is countering that Trump was simply exercising his First Amendment rights and that his calls for supporters to fight were purely metaphorical. And so as you watch the trial, it is ostensibly going to be about the substance, about whether Donald Trump, when he was president, committed high crimes and misdemeanors. But while that's going on, I think a lot of the discussion for the senators, especially Republican senators, really is going to be about process. And indeed, you likely hear a lot about a procedural defense. It seems that most Republican senators are reluctant to defend Donald Trump on the merits. After all, last month, then Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell accused Trump of having provoked the January 6th attack. What Republican senators are doing instead is questioning the propriety of holding the trial. We saw last week that Rand Paul introduced a motion arguing that the trial was unconstitutional because Trump was no longer in office. That motion was defeated, but 45 of the 50 Republican senators voted for it, signaling for them that they would presumably vote to acquit because they didn't think holding the trial was proper. And again, if you assume all 50 Democrats vote for impeachment, you need to get 17 Republicans to go along, and that pretty much looks like a long shot. Now, I should say the argument that the trial is unconstitutional takes us into relatively uncharted waters. This is not a settled matter of law, and you can certainly find distinguished legal minds arguing that the 45 Republican senators are right. But I think the bulk bulk of the historical evidence and legal reasoning lies on the side that the trial is, in fact, constitutional. I mean, at a minimum, the Constitution doesn't forbid such a trial. Beyond that, accepting Rand Paul's argument requires believing that the framers, who were quite concerned about the possibility that a demagogue would derail the government, and presumably pretty bright group of people, created a system in which the demagogue they feared could get out of punishment and being disbarred from holding office, either by ending his term or resigning quickly. So I think you're going to hear those arguments being tossed back and forth. And really, in closing, I would just say it gets us to the significance of what is going on right now. And I think just seeing how that motion by Rand Paul was voted suggests that Donald Trump still dominates the Republican Party. If you go back to when Senator McConnell accused then-President Trump of having provoked the attack on January 6th, there was a lot of speculation, expectation that that signaled that the Republican Party was going to distance itself from Donald Trump. But I think in the weeks since, in good part because of the vocal support for Trump within the Republican Party, the tide has sort of gone in the opposite direction. And we're seeing that not just in the reluctance to repudiate Trump's behavior, but the unwillingness to repudiate Marjorie Taylor Greene, the Georgia House Republican who traffics in wild conspiracy theories and has called for violence against her Democratic colleagues, or the lack of willingness of many Republicans to defend Liz Cheney, the number three House Republican who voted to impeach Trump. She is one of 10 House Republicans to do that. All of this means, I think, that the so-called Trump fever hasn't broken, which means it's going to be hard for Joe Biden to achieve his goal of revitalizing the idea of bipartisan collaboration and cooperation. And that intense partisanship, which we've seen for the last several years, looks like it's going to continue to be the norm in Washington politics. Bob, let's shift gears and talk about Myanmar. It's been in the news a lot in the last several days after the Burmese military overthrew the fledgling democratic government that was led by Aung San Suu Kyi, former winner of the Nobel Peace Prize. The Southeast Asian nation's commander-in-chief and the military acted presumably because they disliked the results of Myanmar's election last November, and they accused Aung San Suu Kyi and members of her party of having engaged in election fraud. Can you bring us up to speed, Bob, on what the situation looks like in Myanmar?
Yes, Jim, and it's not looking good. We've, in some ways, distressingly familiar kind of script involved. We've had in the last 24 hours or so charges brought against Aung San Suu Kyi that she had improperly imported something like 5 or 6 walkie-talkies into the country. On those grounds, I've seen reports that she may be sentenced up to 2 years. Another top civilian leader has been charged with violating coronavirus pandemic procedures that will take him out of action for a while. In general, the government has taken Facebook down, which is has been for Myanmar society an important way for people to communicate and express themselves and so forth. So Facebook is not functioning there right now and really seem to be impervious to some of the international condemnation, although I should say fairly muted from the immediate region in Asia, including from democracies. But internationally, there has been condemnation of the coup. And, you know, so it's going to be sort of what we're already accustomed to up to about 10 years ago in Myanmar, which is tightly controlled military-led government. Now, they're saying this would be like a one-year period, but there are signs that it could go on far beyond that. So, you know, these are tough times for Myanmar. I would say that there is a little bit of the genie of sort of democratic, you know, kindlings and so forth is out of the bottle, to the extent that you're seeing some more pushback from society. You're seeing in one area, a lot of healthcare professionals have been staging protests, which could be quite significant amid the pandemic. So we'll have to see how the military plays its cards. The initial reporting is also that, you know, there's sort of few options for outside governments, including the United States, to exercise much leverage in Myanmar at the moment, Jim.
Well, Bob, can I sort of pull on that last thread? Because the United States has come out and condemned the coup, but thus far, as best I can tell, has not taken any tangible steps. And I've heard people discussing sort of the pros and cons of acting more forcefully, particularly using sanctions to signal displeasure with Myanmar. And one argument I hear is that it's important for the United States to move and sanction Myanmar, or to sanction members of the now ruling government for the coup. On the other hand, what I'm hearing is that if the United States does that, one very likely consequence is to drive the new Burmese government into the hands of the Chinese, and that from a broader strategic point of view, sort of pressuring Myanmar would be counterproductive. How do you assess those conflicting dynamics?
Yeah, you've gotten to the kind of the crux of the problem with Myanmar. First of all, you know, for those grappling with a huge influx of challenges, global challenges, and if you're sitting in the State Department, you know, why does Myanmar matter? Well, that's part of it. You had a large country strategically located that was certainly in China's orbit, but was showing its desire to become a democracy. And even though the military, even under the democratic opening, the military held a lot of cards, had a lot of sway in the country, it was moving in that direction. The coup was a response to the country maybe moving too fast because there was overwhelming support for Aung San Suu Kyi's party in the last election. And they were actually about to formally take over, start a new term when the coup happened. From what I've seen from various analysis of the way Myanmar has been run by the military, it's not sort of a given that they run into the arms of China. Yes, China has exercised a lot of influence there. Myanmar is on the Belt and Road Initiative that China is conducting throughout the region, throughout the world, actually. And so that means money being provided for all sorts of infrastructure projects. And China has also supported Myanmar at the UN Security Council, both currently that they seem to be quashing any sort of immediate moves towards condemning the coup or any sort of strong statement by the Security Council. But even previously, when there was very strong findings from UN professionals themselves that the Myanmar military was behind ethnic cleansing against Rohingya Muslims, and China, you know, effectively blocked any sort of major action or statement by the Security Council in that case. That was just several years ago. So at the same time, the experts on Myanmar say, you know, there's not this great coziness between the military clique in Myanmar and China. They will gauge their options and do what they must. Certainly, if you have the U.S. moving to rapidly set in targeted sanctions against an entire ruling clique there, it, you know, narrows their options. But by the same token, this is one of those important sort of defining moments for the role of values and democracy promotion in the Biden administration, trying to signal that they are back, that the U.S. is back in the business of promoting democracy. They were out quickly with condemning the coup. It must be said the Trump administration had targeted sanctions against some of the military leadership in Myanmar because of the crackdown on the Rohingya. And those are still in place. However, the Obama administration had moved to lift previous sanctions that had been in place and at a time when it seemed like there was becoming a closer and closer U.S.-Myanmar relationship. Back to your original question, Jim, it's a tough position to be in. I think they're going to have to, you're probably going to see something like some more targeted sanctions, but maybe not as sweeping as some human rights and democracy promotion organizations would like to see. And then potentially working with other countries in the region to try to influence the military leadership to allow some sort of role for the civilians who so far are under their sway.
I should note that if you look at the evidentiary record, there's not a lot of reason to be optimistic that imposing sanctions forces coup plotters to change their mind or to force countries back on the democratic path. And then a lot of the reason for using sanctions is to signal displeasure because you want to align yourself with these broader values of wanting to endorse and support democracy and to criticize movements away from it. But I'm curious, Bob, you mentioned the Rohingya. Does the coup have any impact that we can detect on the treatment of Rohingya in Myanmar? Because it has been horrific, and it was horrific under this new democratic government that we were applauding and were trying to nurse along. And one of the reasons why Aung San Suu Kyi went from an acclaimed hero to being someone with lots of people saying her Nobel Prize should be taken away from her.
Yeah, no, you touch on a really important point. Let's recall, Aung San Suu Kyi went to the Netherlands, went to The Hague to offer a very strong defense of the country's military campaign that was, again, called ethnic cleansing and forced close to 1 million Rohingya to flee. And she said that there were some instances of intercommunal violence. They'd been exaggerated, that military was acting against, quote unquote, terrorists and insurgents. So this, again, in the face of other evidence, strongly to the contrary, and a lot of other evidence, this was very dismaying to the human rights community, to those who had held up Aung San Suu Kyi as an important and sort of a paragon, really, for rights and democracy. So some were saying, you know, she was navigating a tough road with the military still holding a lot of sway, but still in all, it was a strong, very strong defense that shocked a lot of people. And so I don't think anybody can expect any sort of softening towards the Rohingya, certainly. In fact, one could imagine that there's sort of to be a longer term stay in Bangladesh. And these are, in some cases, really awful conditions that they're staying in. Bangladesh has tried to set up these tent cities and has worked with international bodies to try to to make them livable. But it's not clear if any of them are ever going back to Myanmar and to enjoy anything like equal rights. The thing that people are pointing to with more concern is, aside from the Rohingya, there are a number of other ethnic groups that had in various times taken up arms against the central government in Myanmar that they had achieved somewhat of a wary peace with. There's concern that you could have a number of other civil conflicts firing up again. And so that's raising concern. And it's sort of, again, the same old with Myanmar. Multiple clashes with ethnic minorities, country isolated economically. And then it's a question of, does it really become more tethered to China than it had been before, even during long years of military rule?
Well, this is certainly going to be a story to follow, Bob.
Jim, another one that we've been following and that we can take a little bit of solace in is the continuation of the last remaining major nuclear arms treaty between Russia and the United States. In President Biden's first call with Vladimir Putin, they agreed to extend New START, which avoided the February 5th expiration deadline. U.S. Secretary of State Tony Blinken said in a statement this week that, quote, especially during times of tension, verifiable limits on Russia's intercontinental range nuclear weapons are vitally important. So, Jim, could you tell us a little bit more about this extension of the treaty and what comes next?
Sure, Bob. I think my headline would be that great powers can move quickly, very quickly, when they want to do so. I'll note that Biden and Putin spoke on January 26th, as you noted. The Russian Duma, their parliament, voted unanimously the next day to extend the treaty, and Putin signed the law ratifying the extension 2 days later. Now, U.S. law doesn't require any congressional action or any Senate action, and yesterday, Secretary of State Antony Blinken announced that the United States had formally agreed to extending New START, which again was set to expire tomorrow. The speed of the movement here suggests two things. One, both sides very much wanted to get a deal done. Both saw extending the terms of New START as being in their national interest. And I'll note that they went with a 5-year extension, which is the maximum allowed under the terms of the treaty. Second thing I would note, that as testy as U.S.-Russian relations are and are likely to be, this agreement signals that there is some room for cooperation and agreement. Now, the big question here is, what does the treaty actually do? You may recall it went into force 10 years ago. It built on a succession of U.S.-Soviet and U.S.-Russian agreements controlling, limiting offensive nuclear forces. That began with the deal that Richard Nixon, Leonid Brezhnev struck back in 1972. The New START Treaty has a number of provisions, but in the main, what it does is limit the number of deployed strategic nuclear warheads to 1,550 on each side.
And so those are the long-range ones. These are the ones that, you know, from a Russian base to a U.S. city, the reach is
right
there.
They're designed to hit the other side's territory, as opposed to tactical nuclear weapons, which are much shorter range weapons, not covered. New START, which is critical, and we'll get to that in a second. I'll just note the other thing that the New START Treaty does is limit the number of delivery systems, that is launchers, to 700. And again, New START was part of this long trend that really did drive down the size of U.S. and Soviet Russian stockpiles. I mean, if you go back to the 1960s, you're looking at both sides having tens of thousands of warheads. And now on both sides, you're down well under 10,000. I'll also note that there has not been, with the New START Treaty, the complaints about Russian compliance that you see with, or that we saw with, other U.S.-Russian, U.S.-Soviet arms control agreements. Now, that doesn't mean that New START Treaty is popular here in the United States. It has its critics. And they level really two criticisms. One is that it only covers strategic long-range weapons designed to hit the other side's territory, and it leaves aside tactical nuclear weapons. And the Russians have been developing more and more tactical nuclear weapons, and so that was seen as a flaw. Second criticism leveled against New START is that it, like its predecessors, was a bilateral agreement between the United States and Russia. It did not cover the activities of other nuclear powers, of which there are seven, and one in particular being China. Now, the counterargument is that, well, the reason you have this bilateral agreement is because the size of the U.S. and Russian arsenals are just much larger than any other country.
Something like 90% of the overall arsenal, I believe, is still the case.
Exactly right, Bob. And if you look at it, the United States has essentially 5,800 warheads. The Russians, about 6,800 warheads. Again, there are warheads that are deployed, and there are warheads that are sort of sitting in warehouses and the like and aren't on an active status. China has about 320. So there's an order of magnitude difference between what China has and what the United States and Russia has, though. China has this is true across its military, been modernizing its nuclear weapon systems, and they are increasing in size. And the concern is eventually at some point, this could shift the strategic balance. And so we need to engage the Chinese in conversations. And I'll note in this score that when Secretary of State Blinken spoke yesterday, the United States was now formally going back to New START, formally extending it. He noted that the Biden administration was committed to working toward arms control with China. And that's a laudable aspiration. My sense is the message from Beijing is not interested, not going to happen. And again, the decision to move forward in extending New START does take place in the midst of existing U.S.-Russian tensions and tensions that are likely to continue and maybe escalate. We spoke last week about the Russian arrest of opposition leader Alexei Navalny. Russian legal system works very quickly because he's already been tried and sentenced to 3.5 years in jail for his opposition activities. I think I mentioned last week that President Putin would not refer to Navalny by name, but called him the poisoned one. I was wrong. He refers to him as the patient. But nonetheless, Navalny's arrest has triggered more protests in Russia. The United States has been critical, but it's much like what we talked about with Myanmar a moment ago. You can talk about doing sanctions. No real expectation that's going to change the calculations in the Kremlin. What you're doing is you're trying to signal your disapproval of what's going on. I think what's going to happen in Russia is going to be determined by Russians, not by outside forces, and likewise the same in Myanmar. Though you can make the argument by criticizing and standing up for values you are encouraging, giving support, and helping to invigorate opposition movements. But again, we're going to sort of see where the U.S.-Russian relationship goes. We've had one positive development, but definitely a lot of headwinds on the way.
And I think that the arms control community has breathed a bit of a sigh of relief while still, for the reasons you mentioned, there's a great deal of concern about what comes next, especially if there's any way to generate discussions with China.
Well, certainly, Bob, because we've seen essentially the dismantlement of almost all of the bilateral agreements between the United States and Russia. The issues the United States wishes to talk about, for example, Russia's increased reliance on tactical nuclear weapons as part of its military doctrine, seems to be an issue that the Russians aren't interested in. There's talk about a whole new wave of weapons, particularly these hypersonic delivery systems, which by some telling could shake the strategic balance. By other telling, is a technology whose impact has been overrated. We're going to hear a lot more about this in the year to come. But again, the big question is, can you find a way to bring China into the process to the satisfaction of the other two leading nuclear powers? And again, I think on that score, the signs are pretty pessimistic. But Bob, let's switch gears and do what we do every week at this point in the podcast, and that is talk about our audience figure of the week. Listeners can vote on or tweet us their suggestions for audience figure of the week at CFR_org. This week, our audience selected in our Twitter poll 50,000 plus dead in Tigray. Bob, can you tell us why this is the audience figure of the week?
Sure, Jim. Our audiences tend to be acutely aware of humanitarian problems and crises, and there seems to be a major one playing out in the Tigray region, the northernmost region of Ethiopia. I have seen more recent reports saying up to 52,000, so 52,000 people killed since this conflict between Tigrayan officials or the party known as the Tigray People's Liberation Front, which has control over a number of forces against the central government forces in Ethiopia. And those are figures that are attributed to opposition parties from the region, so I'll take that as you will. But there have been also reports from humanitarian officials and others in the region that there are a number of serious developments going on there, whether or not the death tolls are that high. There are all sorts of other concerns that are getting only worse, and the unwillingness of the Ethiopian government to come out and sort of transparently report on what's going on is part of the area of concern. You have now up to 2 million people displaced from the conflict in the region. You had a pre-existing population of refugees of close to 100,000 from neighboring Eritrea, who are seen to be in really tough circumstances there as well. And there's concern about it destabilizing across the borders into Sudan and creating just kind of the kind of regional mess that countries had looked to Ethiopia to help, you know, get under control. This is, again, erupted in November. You have people from Tigray typically enjoyed positions of power in Ethiopia. The government of Abiy Ahmed has been cracking down on what it sees as seditionist activity in the region. And Abiy has also, though, claimed that there has not been a single civilian killed in the military assault in Tigray, although there have been a lot of reports to the contrary. Abiy Ahmed, who himself was a Nobel Peace Laureate, like Aung San Suu Kyi we previously mentioned, has come under a great deal of criticism for the way he's responded to the Tigray revolt and the way he's continuing to respond to this dire humanitarian situation. Among the government responses has been sort of closing down aid corridors to UN and other international bodies. You even have people such as Jan Egeland, who's currently the head of the Norwegian Refugee Council, a major actor in the space, but also he's a former top UN aid official. He said he's rarely seen aid response so impeded in the 40 years he's worked in the humanitarian field. Again, there's a great deal of concern in this region.
Bob, can we talk a bit about this issue of the aid delivery and the broader issue of the conflict we're seeing in northern Ethiopia? Because for several years since Abiy Ahmed became prime minister of Ethiopia, the talk was the great success he had made in making peace with neighboring Eritrea, that he was bringing about a more open, less repressive domestic environment in Ethiopia. A lot of people cheering him on. Again, Ethiopia is a very significant country. I think it's the second most populous country in Africa. Now we've seen this sort of sharp reversal. Is this being driven, to the best we can tell, by Prime Minister Abiy? Is it that he's actually being pushed aside by other parts of the political spectrum in Ethiopia? If we have any sense of why we're getting such a hardline response in one in particular that is impeding relief efforts, but also denying what seems to be pretty undeniable that civilians are dying in Tigray.
Yeah, I think this response, especially on the humanitarian front, has been concerning and puzzling in some ways, because, again, you have a country, Ethiopia, that was on the ascent both regionally and internationally with the ascent of Abiy Ahmed. It's worth pointing out that he's a member of the Oromo. This is the majority ethnic group in the country. Tigrayans are about 6% of Ethiopia's population, but they had been traditionally in power, and they started to feel targeted by the Abiy government's choices, and so started to turn against it. And then also they called their own regional elections, which ran counter to the government's decision to postpone elections as part of the COVID crisis and so forth. And so it seems to be, on the one hand, kind of a traditional kind of ethnic struggle going on. We've seen it play out in many places in Africa and around the world. But to your question about whether Abiy is driving it, it does seem like he is using his authority to drive this. Again, where this kind of clampdown on sort of a humanitarian response and then really what seemed to be incredibly brutal response that has swept up civilians comes from a place that I think surprises a lot of people, because he had been seen as a kind of a uniter and had been, you know, saying and doing the right things initially, again, so much so that he was lauded by the Nobel Committee. So we're back into kind of blood and soil politics. And again, it's raising a lot of concern about where this could go. This is, as you say, it's the second most populous country in Africa. It had been seen traditionally as a stabilizer in a really kind of rough and turbulent part of Africa, in East Africa. And had a war against Eritrea, a brutal sort of mini war, if that makes sense. But his moves to pacify that were seen as a success. Adding to the confusion in the Tigray region is that there are reports of Eritrean soldiers helping Ethiopian soldiers to put down, you know, the rebellion by Tigrayan forces. And so it's not at all clear exactly what's going on there, which is again why there seems to be this total blackout on news and on allowing in humanitarian workers, because humanitarian workers typically become sources for media organizations about what's going on in various regions. It seems like they want to just prevent that completely. It must be noted that, again, I mentioned the UN in response to Myanmar. UN has been kind of muted so far in response to this. They have met on the Tigray crisis. UN officials are best positioned, as they typically are, to bring aid in any sort of quick capacity. But the Security Council has been muted. The US has spoken out on this, but, you know, it's not clear yet what sort of role any sort of outside actors can play to try to bring this to an end. And so, again, I think it's one of the reasons why it has surfaced, this 50,000 figure has surfaced, because I think these numbers go so far beyond what we have been hearing so far about the level of and the lethality of the government response to the uprising.
It's a very sad situation, Bob.
And that's our look at the world next week. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. The European Union's foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, visits Russia. And Tampa Bay plays Kansas City in American football's Super Bowl.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. And leave us a review while while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the host or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program was produced by Zoe Collins with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Zoe also did double duty as our recording engineer. Thank you, Zoe. Special thanks go out to Anna Shortridge and Bethany Wright for their assistance. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long and stay healthy out there.